Well, good morning. I'll do a few introductory comments here on the phone for those on the internet and those here in the room. I'm Walt Kovalik, the Acting Deputy Regional Administrator for US EPA here in Chicago, and we're very grateful for those of you who are signing on to be on the internet seminar and here in the room who are investors, angel, and venture capital investors. This is a new kind of outreach for EPA, and as you may have gathered from our invitation letter, one of our major goals is to get some feedback from you about whether we should be putting out the kind of materials we're going to be talking about in a few minutes as we get into the meeting. We'll go around the room here in just a minute. We've got several resource people sitting in the room surrounding us here at EPA in Chicago, those who had something to do with writing the need statements. So they're going to be available after the meeting and even for questions as we go along. And because this is an internet seminar, there are speakers from around the country in Cincinnati, Boston, and Washington who are going to join us for presentations. Those of you who are on the web, I hope you're into the seminar by registering and going to the Emerging Drivers picture of the opening, and then there's a picture that I couldn't get airbrushed to take out 10 years and 10 pounds of me for the opening, and that's where we are. So maybe I can go around on the web and see if that's where you're, if you're there on the internet and also there on the phone. I have a list of the non-EPA people who have registered, so I thought I'd go around and see if you've signed on. This is just the random order you registered in. Is Jim Adox from Ann Arbor on the phone?
Present.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Star Marcello had registered here in Chicago from the Pulse.
I'm here. Hi. Good morning.
Welcome. Mike Moore from the Norris Institute in Minneapolis.
Yes, I'm here. Good morning. Good
morning. Welcome. There may be a representative from Piper Jaffray. I know Doug Cameron couldn't be on. Is someone else on? Okay, in Minneapolis. Galen Williams here in Chicago from Maroon Global. Okay. Phil Hurd from Cimarron Capital Partners in Baltimore.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. Steve Lasniak from Golden Angels Network in Milwaukee. Not yet. Bob Savage, one of our speakers. Are you on already, Bob?
I am, Walt. Yes.
Good morning. And your colleague, Jeff Williams, is with you, I guess?
Brought this with me today.
Okay. And finally, Rick Kaiser from Clean Wave Ventures in Cincinnati. Are you on? Not yet. Okay. Well, why don't we go around the room here, and the phones should be working, and just introduce ourselves, the investors, and I'm very pleased that we have a couple of our federal agency partners here today from the Economic Development Administration and General Services who have been helpful. Robert Sawyer and I have been encountered several times. He's in favor of starting businesses, and you're in favor of starting businesses, so he's a fellow traveler, and we're really grateful that Sandy Conchola is here from General Services Administration. They actually added some needs to our needs list that you're going to be reacting to later, so glad she's with us. Go ahead.
To get the slide with your picture on it, on a page that basically has the agenda on it, then the opening is blued. Just click on the blue to go there.
Yes, you should, or you may have a forward and back button at the top of the page.
Okay, it's running a little slow right now, but that's what we're doing. All right.
Yeah. You've checked in already, so you should have buttons at the top. Yeah, I should do my little internet instruction here. Are you there? Okay. And if you're joining us by phone and you don't have a mute button, you can use *6 and #6 for mute and unmute. And we've learned from years and years of experience using this system not to put us on hold, because some companies have music that plays. And then it gets very kumbaya in here because we're listening to music while we're talking. So if you're not talking, please use the mute button, or you can use *6 on our system and #6 for on mute and off mute. I've had a couple people join us. Were they investors join us by any chance? Is that the last minute? Okay, looks like we've had some more in the room join us. Why don't we go around the table here and we'll get started on my left. So.
I'm Keith Crandell, co-founder and managing director of Arch Venture Partners, which is a 23-year-old venture capital fund focused on seed and early stage investing out of the leading research laboratories around the United States, as well as the national lab system. We have worked helped co-found or led the first round of financing in 120 companies over the last 23 years. Many of them have been in the instrumentation area, including Illumina, a leading genotyping company, as well as Ahura Scientific, which does a portable Raman spectrometer that's used to identify unknown liquid solids and pastes for safety and security applications. And I'm a reformed chemist myself from way back, and spent a considerable amount of time, well, 5 years at Argon, looking at technologies and spinning them out back in the late 1980s before we became a private independent group.
Ken's one of our early speakers later, so. Go ahead, Alex.
My name is Alex King. I'm a partner and co-founder of a firm called Invention Bridge. And what we do is we partner with labs and universities, primarily their technology transfer offices, to help them evaluate and figure out how to spin out next generation technologies. Actually, Arch is one of our venture sponsors that we're working with. So Keith's been very generous in offering his advice and knowledge going as we traverse through this. My business partner, Amy Francetic, she is supposed to be here. She's probably stuck in traffic right now. But one of the things that she's done over the last couple of years is work with Argonne National Laboratories, and they were just awarded a Department of Energy EIR2 grant to staff someone there to help identify work with the Technology Transfer Office to spin out a potentially commercially viable technology. So,
okay, thank you.
Alan Wolf, I'm the acting director of our office in Forest State, and
here in Chicago.
Here in Chicago. Paul Lazar, I'm an EPA grantee.
I'm KU volunteer scientist for EPA, and my office actually hosts a senior environmental technology officer and provision vacant for internet equipment team. And in addition to that, and as you probably can tell from the wonderful brochure that we received here, and there's some opportunities for commercializing the environmental technology. One of the things my office does is to engage other federal government agencies, such as USDA, such as some. And there are opportunities not only in domestic markets, but also international potential markets. So I'm here to do business.
And learn.
KU is the home of our National Environmental Technology Council and headquarters, too. So thank you for coming.
I'm Ira Weiss, and I help run a group called High Park Angel, and I also teach at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. And I've been doing angel and venture investing for about 15 years, mostly by running angel funds.
And Ira is one of our speakers a little bit later.
Hi, good morning. My name is Robert Sawyer. I run the Regional Office of the Economic Development Administration. The reason I'm here is that for the last few years we've recognized that two of the most important things to revive and sustain the economy are entrepreneurial development and technology transfer. And by technology transfer, I don't mean the generation of intellectual property. I mean putting it into products that people can produce and earn wages. An example is right now fuel cells are manufactured by PhDs. We need to get the manufacturing process to the point where people with associate's degrees are manufacturing. So that's the area. The things that we've been involved with in the last 5 or 6 years, we've helped Jumpstart, which is an organization in Northeast Ohio, and many of you have heard about, that identifies, nurtures, and invests in entrepreneurs. We've just invested in the Chicagoland Entrepreneurial Center to do kind of the same thing in Northern Illinois. We've just invested in Illinois Institute of Technology for their incubator. We've just invested in Axion Chicago to do micro lending. So that's the kind of thing we've been involved with and are interested in doing more.
Good morning. I'm Sandy Conchola, and I'm with the General Services Administration. I'm the Director of Facilities Management and Services Programs for the Great Lakes region. And GSA right now is all about high-performance green buildings, and that's why I'm here.
Thanks so much, Sandy. So, sorry, we have to go around here. Sorry, John.
Good morning. I'm John Vance. I'm the managing partner of Illinois Ventures, which is about a seven-year-old seed and early stage venture investment firm aimed at research-derived businesses coming out of the federal labs and universities, primarily either in the Midwest or deriving out of the Midwest. We've had a lot of activity in some of the areas that we're coming with, in water and industrial processing, and probably the most notable would be Andalize, which is in the heavy metal and analyze testing area. So my partners, Roger, I'll let them tell you about it. But a lot of interest in this area, very pleased to be involved.
Thanks for coming.
Ron Kirshner with Heartland Angels. Heartland Angels is an angel endeavor, primarily investing in the Midwest. Typically speaking, either platform technologies or disruptive technologies in energy, food, new materials, and life science. That's our main thing.
Good.
And John Regan, John's partner in Illinois Ventures here.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. Oh, one more. Yes, you were introduced, Amy, but welcome.
Yes, virtually. I'm Amy Francetic. I'm one of the co-founders of Invention Bridge, and we're working to commercialize university and lab-based R&D into startups and licenses, and we're doing some work with Argonne in Northwestern America.
Thanks for being here. Alex, do you want to drag that microphone down that way a little bit more? It's plenty of coverage in there.
I'm Cheryl Prayer from Science Liaison, and then there's my colleague Michelle over there.
Cheryl and Michelle are responsible for that we have this meeting, so I'm very grateful to them. And you can't see it on the phone, but we have about 21 EPA staffers surrounding this table we're sitting at who, as I said this time before, some of you signed on, are either the authors of some of the needs that you're reading about or the sponsors. So if we get to that part of the agenda and some detailed question pops up, we can get to it without taking up too much time. We're trying to be very compressed here with your time and get this done in 2 hours. So I'm not going around the whole room. I'm being impolite, but they understand that because they have to work with me. Did any other investors join us on the phone in the last 3 minutes?
Oh, this is David Christian from Rock Venture Partners.
Oh, David, good. Yes, thank you for signing on. Okay, we're going to go to the, I've described this meeting a little bit like going to a restaurant for a meal, and the first set of slides that we're going to go to next, which is EPA's role in fostering technology, I'm going to move through these really fast. This is more to describe the restaurant you're sitting in, that it's not DOE and it's not NSF. And it's not SBA, so we wanted to do that. We actually used these at a venture capital summit we had in November with about five firms and some leading EPA career people who were meeting with them. So this is a fast forward through our role in technologies, which has less to do with money and more to do with other factors. And many of you already may know this, but we thought it would be useful. And if you want to stop me, please do, but otherwise on the phone as well, but I'm just going to go on. So the outline, the second slide of the outline basically is to give you a little bit of a taste of our mission and budget, how we operate and implement while you're here in a regional office and how that fits, and a couple of slides at the end about how we fit with technology development, at least as we see it from the inside. The next slide, three, is this is in your packet if you're here at the table as well on the to a page as well on the screen. Probably already know that we are not a cabinet-level agency. We're one of 20-some independent regulatory agencies like the Federal Trade Commission and the Consumer Product Safety Commission and others that report directly to the president, but almost uniformly through the last three or four or five administrations, regardless of party, the EPA administrator sits at the cabinet meetings and often is deeply involved in policy development because environment keeps popping up. Most of the rest of the world has a cabinet-level ministry for the environment. Most recent example is that the EPA administrator joined the Strategic Economic Dialogue in China, along with the Treasury Secretary and the Commerce Secretary and others. Our main mission is, in a few phrases in most of our, is just public protect public health and the environment, but it's basically cordoned off in about 20-some different statutes. We're not like the Department of Interior, whose mission is to protect and conserve public lands. End of mission. We're actually organized, and many of you have worked with EPA along these statutory lines, protecting air, water, waste. Many of these were passed during crisis moments in the past, such as the catching on fire of the Cuyahoga River in 1970, the fact that Pittsburgh was pitch black at noon one day in 1948, led to the Clean Air Act, things like that. The Superfund law, this comprehensive law listed up there, was passed after Love Canal in the 1980s. The ones in white are pollution control laws, and there are several others of those, and the ones in yellow refer to the fact that we actually regulate products. We're the ones who not only regulate pesticides that go on agricultural land. If you go home tonight and look at scrubbing bubbles in your bathroom, it says this is a registered fungicide. Do not use inconsistent with the label. It's a federal offense, and all of us are sometimes terrified by that. But at any rate, the main purpose of the law is to register economic poisons, and which are applied to agricultural land and part of our major industry in this country. And the Toxic Substance Control Act covers basically the smorgasbord of chemicals that aren't foods and drugs and cosmetics, which is over with the Food and Drug Administration, that aren't pesticides in the pesticide law, and that aren't low-level radiation like the kind your dentist uses, which are regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That leaves all other chemicals to fall under the TSCA law, and I won't say much more about it right now, but we can talk about it if you want. Moving on, this is a picture. The next slide is number four, is our look at our budget by our strategic plan. This is a couple of years old, but basically you see the wedges there devoted to the yellow wedge from 12 to 2 to air, followed by water around the clock there. Land preservation and restoration refers to cleaning up contaminated sites as well as regulating hazardous waste. Healthy communities and ecosystems is the place where those pesticide and toxic substances authorities lie. Then the enforcement resources of that wedge from 11 to 10 to 12 on the clock cut across all of the work that we do. The code there, the size of the wedge has to do with the budget size, and the FTE refers to full-time equivalent. So that's the number of EPA people on the lower right, 2,800 and some that are devoted to, 2,901 devoted to water pollution issues. Going on to the budget itself, again, please stop me, I'm just going as fast as I can. 12 to 2 up there is evidence of the fact that the vast majority of environmental protection in the United States is carried out by states, tribes, and other governments, so we give $1.2 billion of our budget in grants to support the water program in Illinois and the air program in Illinois and the hazardous waste program in Illinois and the pest, and similarly for all 50 states. So, in fact, they are our partners. One of the first things we say to new employees is we are not a parent-child with states and tribes. We are co-implementers, because without them, the permits wouldn't get issued and the inspections wouldn't get done and the cases wouldn't get filed and the environment wouldn't get cleaned up. $1.715 billion from 10 to 12 on that chart refers primarily to our state revolving funds. This is where we finance wastewater treatment plants and drinking water plants around the country with funds that the states run, and they are revolving, where they take money in, do loans, bring money back. And this was our participation in the stimulus program. In fact, we got, EPA got another, this region got another $1.1 billion alone in stimulus money for SRF programs in our six-state region, which I'll mention later. And the wedge from, 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock, there is the wedge that has basically operates the Superfund program, even though there is not a separate tax finance trust fund that's appropriated separately. So if you look from 2 o'clock to 8 o'clock on that chart, those $4 billion basically run the rest of the agency, all those programs that I talked about in the first slide there, air, water, waste, pesticide, toxic, etc. The next slide is a description of how we impact other people in the country. That's why all our folks who sit on planes, as I do, get accosted by why their car is diesel, why they can't use pesticides, why the air isn't fit to breathe, and because we touch so many people and organizations. As you see, several hundreds of thousands of permitted facilities under the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, which is a hazardous waste program. We have impacts on gas stations, dry cleaners, print shops in terms of our regs, so that's what the 20 million small businesses refers to. And, of course, governments have to comply, the wastewater treatment plants in every town and village and the drinking water plants in every town and village have some requirements that they have to meet in terms of producing quality drinking water or not polluting the streams. So we actually have a major, and Alan only talks to about 100,000 a year, so he's in this region, so it keeps us busy. But many, many of these permitted facilities, again, are with our state partners. They're writing the permits. They're issuing the enforcement orders. They're doing the inspections with us. Moving on to the next slide, which says operations implementation. There's a two-slide set here that basically talks about our mission, which, despite all the statutes telling us to clean the air and work on the water and drinking water and so forth, we're basically exercising discretion, figuring out where to draw the line. How much mercury could be in the water, how much mercury can be in that applied pesticide. And that's what mainly that function is carried out in the reg writing that goes on in headquarters. And in fact, part of this meeting is talking about regs that are coming up that we think might create a market in the future. The second bullet there refers to the traditional way that our statutes are written, not so much that we're traditional, on how we do regulations. Several of our statutes, like the one in water, call for best available control technology. So that means we go out and study the technologies that work on a particular industry category, and that's the technology, the level of treatment that results from that study might be the standard that's set for how good can a pulp and paper plant be in removing ammonia, for example. That set of initials for air, racked back layer, refers to reasonably achievable, best available, lowest achievable emission. There's a variety of acronyms there, but basically the air law is driven by that same kind of technology, what's out there that will allow progress to be made. And as I'll comment on a later slide, of course, that has a two-edged sword. It helps us push to where the industry might be now, but of course then it freezes things. And the poor next person who has a good idea has a devil of a time trying to get into the system to ratchet it up a notch, and we'll talk about that. Yeah. In the air program, we set ambient standards for particulate matter, for ozone and other contaminants, and then we back that up to where are the sources, the power plants, the industry, the cars that produce that, and we try and write regulations that affect those sources. The air program is one of the few programs where we're engaged in emission trading. You may know that that's going on for sulfur oxides. You can go over the board and trade. I think can trade in sulfur oxide air in credits for that. A lot of what we do in the Superfund program is risk assessment based. We go out to a site. We figure out what are the risks that are posed by the contaminated soil and groundwater versus what are the exposures and draw a line there. And we have a fairly high standard under the Toxic Substances Act where we have to figure out what unreasonable risk is, which is a pretty difficult goal. I'll keep going faster because we're fine. Along with these command and control strategies over the last decade, I'm on the next slide, we've developed some newer ones. The vast majority of enforcement, as you all know, I think the statistic used to be that 80% of the people in this country try and pay their taxes correctly if they can figure out how to do it, and thanks to some software, most of us get it right, I guess. Similarly, we don't go out and expect a lot of people try and do the right thing, even those small sources, and we have a large compliance assistance program, so we're not out just with our black hat catching the bad guys, of whom there are some still, but we also try and help with compliance assistance centers. We have several kind of partnership programs that help companies who want to star by themselves, like Energy Star and WasteWise and ClimateWise and others. And we also are doing partnering for economic gains, the whole Brownfields Redevelopment Program that EPA operates, where we work with cities to try and make what used to be an environmental detriment into an economic development. Of course, what's going on in the middle of all this is the development of international standards. You know, we're the three large economies in the world, the U.S., EU, and China, and so a lot of their requirements end up bumping back to us in terms of EMS and ISO standards, which some of you may be familiar with. But as always, we keep enforcement in mind because that levels the playing field for both the good guys and the bad guys that are left, so that we're making sure they do the right thing. taking a breath. And the next slide is just to show you a picture of the 10 standard federal regions. There's not much news here other than for you to see you're in Region 5, the six states that surround Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes are where you're sitting. We have on the phone with us the folks from the Dallas region who did an outreach to investors in the spring, so we're happy to have them join us, and their needs are in the list you have. And there also, I think there's going to be someone on from Region 1, the New England states, who are planning to do an outreach to investors. I'm almost done here. On operations side, the next slide, ops and implementation, we have about 17,000 employees. Full-time equivalent means working full-time for a whole year. About half of those are in the regional offices. You're sitting in the biggest regional office. We have 1,200 employees here. The smallest ones are in Kansas City and Seattle. So the big offices tend to be where the big environmental problems are, Dallas, Atlanta, New York, Chicago, and to some extent San Francisco and Philadelphia. I talked about state and tribal doing a lot of the work. A very science and technology-oriented agency. Most of the people sitting behind us on the table here are scientists, engineers, so that's true in the regions as well as in headquarters. Our Office of Research and Development has over a $700 million budget, and about $440 million of that is extramural, goes out to sponsor research or work on research and development. Next slide is about our perception of our roles in the environmental technology marketplace. The little single light bulb means small, and the medium and large, so we are not a DOE. You know, we're not an NSF with their $6 billion in research funding and their $100 million SBIR program. We do some funding. We do some development. We actually have men and women with screwdrivers in Ann Arbor who develop new technologies for automobiles and carburetors and the way they operate and get patents. But in general, we're not a technology development entity in the same way that most of you know DOE and their labs and so forth. That's not to say we don't have talented people and they aren't working on projects, but they're not doing that same level of development. We are a regulator and enforcer. Thus, for one of the items on the main course of our menu here is to talk about future regs. We do a lot of information brokering, lots of stuff on our websites, and you'll hear about our role as a verification agent, which has helped, in our view, from what we hear, technologies succeed in the market because we verify their performance. We can be a partner, and in general, we're not a first buyer. We do buy for our own account monitoring equipment, and we work with states on that, but in general, we're not in shopping for environmental technologies. We see needs, because those we regulate need those technologies. The next slide is just to tell you that on our website, EPA.gov, ETOP is a continuum that portrays all of our programs laid out according to research, development, demonstration, and diffusion, and sometime you might want to look at that. And finally are my conclusions about what it is that what we do and how we might intersect with people you might invest in, which is possibly why you're here. As I said earlier, for certain niche areas, like drinking water treatment and some parts of air pollution control. I mentioned automobile and diesel retrofit. We actually do have people working on technologies and trying to refine them. Our labs work diligently to find new technologies to take arsenic out of drinking water because we had a mandate to clamp down on the level of arsenic in drinking water in the last few years. But in general, bullet two is correct. We have a secondary level of understanding. If you called someone who's writing the regulations for pulp and paper effluent discharges, they have a contractor studying the best that's available out there and the technologies in order to come to a conclusion about how to regulate pulp and paper and their water discharges. But we have a broad appreciation for technology and several of our partnering programs. The one I listed here, Design for an Environment, actually works with industry to try and reduce emissions. So how we intersect, the next to last slide, with few exceptions, I'm saying we're not a technology development organization. In general, when we come upon an environmental problem, such as greenhouse gases, such as CO2 sequestration, we view it through a regulatory lens. When we came upon the need to do sequestered greenhouse gases, that kicked into gear our program that's in called our underground injection control program. We actually regulate what people can put in underground, we in the States, and store there. So that caused us to be involved in that issue from a point of view and led to inquiries into how the technologies work. actually ran into the elevator one day. The guy was writing that rule. I said, do we know a lot about that? He said, well, the oil and gas industry knows a lot about injecting things into the subsurface, but they don't know a lot about injecting CO2 and how to measure it, how to make sure it doesn't leave the building. We're not called upon to do comprehensive monitoring of technologies, although we do have these niches. And as I mentioned, Payee is here, and we have an environmental technology council, which I'm not going to talk about today, but we are nationally involved across the regions and headquarters. Last slide, we have a regulatory agenda that we're going to be talking about later on. I mentioned the tragedy of our laws in some cases from your point of view and the developer's point of view is once we develop a regulation and fix the best available control technology to take mercury out of pulp and paper, we may not revisit that subject for several years in terms of rewriting a regulation that takes a lot of effort. And so that's the downside of the laws that are driven by best available versus laws that, say, take into account risk and figure out what to do. We know a lot about diffusion, and you're going to hear what we think on these and technologies, and we have a lot of experience with SBIR, which we'll talk about. So that's my quicker. I've been running a little later here, but I wanted you to get that sample. Let me just go to the phone. Does anybody have any clarifying question on that? Or I expect many of you may know some of this. Or in the room? Okay, we'll press on. I said this is like a restaurant. The next part of the agenda is supposed to be the hors d'oeuvres, and my colleagues on the phone are carping at me and Alan here because I said they get four slides. And so there's lots of supplemental material mounted that you can refer to, but I'm trying to do 8 minutes on each of these assets or capabilities we have. I figure you all know about SBIR, but there's something special happening this fall in terms of how much money NSF is going to throw at it and how we are involved with them. So Jim Gallup, who's the National Program Manager for SBIR at EPA, and April Richards, I think maybe his deputy, are on the phone.
Jim, yes, we're here.
So we're going to the slide that says EPA's Small Business Innovative Research Program. You're on, Jim.
And then the slide right after that is SBIR Phase 1 Overview.
Okay, we're there.
What I want to do is to give you some brief information. I believe there is materials on the SBIR program and some of the other references. What I'm going to talk about is that essentially where we are right now in SBIR at EPA. And in the last 2 years, we have been initially working up a collaboration with several different federal agencies, but in the last year, our focus has been with the National Science Foundation. As you can see, this past year, 2009, we received over 500 SBIR proposals. And with those number of proposals, we have an opportunity with our budget of only about $5 million to fund 35 to 40 new technologies. So part of our collaboration has been with the National Science Foundation. And we've now done this, this is now the third solicitation cycle with NSF, so we are starting to see an increased number of proposals in the environmental area and then awards, both phase one and always the SBIR, you have a phase one and a phase two. And in the case of NSF, they've received over 1,700 proposals, but their funding will be probably in the ballpark of 300 awards at $150,000 each. That's double the size of an EPA Phase 1 award. The opportunity right now is that NSF has a solicitation that has all of EPA's topics. It's open right now with the closing date of December 3rd. In the spring of 2010, we will both have Phase 1 solicitations open at approximately the same time, and we encourage companies to submit proposals to both agencies. They'll then have a chance for the NSF award as well as an EPA award. NSF will be making their decision first, so if they are able to get an NSF award, our advice is to take it. You're going to get $150,000 twice our award, and an opportunity for even larger phase two. Our goal looks certainly reasonable to be able to double the number of environmental awards in 2010, and we think that number is going to continue to increase in 2011. On slide number four, EPA collaboration with NSF. You see, NSF has $175 million. So we're talking, under normal conditions, NSF has 20 times EPA's budget. In this period of 2010 into 2009, 2010, almost 35 times EPA's award. So there, with these phase one awards, they have an opportunity then to submit proposals for phase two. And the phase two starting award is $500,000, and they have an opportunity with a commercialization phase 2B to receive an additional $500,000 for a total of $1 million in their, in an NSF phase 2. EPA, we're talking $300,000, $370,000, $400,000, somewhere around $300,000 to $400,000, where we're talking $1 million in the SBIR phase two, which allows companies to really do some additional kind of work and different kinds of technologies with the NSF funding than compared to EPA. Across EPA, what we try to do, and in fact it is mirrored in the proposals and in the solicitation at NSF, about equal weight in water, drinking water, water infrastructure as one area. A second area is air pollution, fuels, biofuels, greenhouse gases. That would be a second area. Waste management is another area. And then a fourth area is pollution prevention, innovation in manufacturing, and nanotechnology. Those are all developing in kind of the process-oriented technologies. Then we also have a green building part of our solicitation, and we were able to get green buildings also as a topic into the NSF solicitation. What I want to talk about as a case study is slide number five, and this is I bring it up because about a month ago I had a chance to visit Houghton, Michigan, which is in the upper Michigan. It must be about 1,000 miles north of Chicago. It's way up there and sitting right out into Lake Superior.
The UP, Jim.
Huh?
It's the UP.
The UP.
The UP.
And this is a case where back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was copper mine, and they were breaking up and then separating the copper from the rest of the materials, and the copper they put on a boat and sent it for further processing and selling it, and the rest of all the waste went into an area of a couple mile along shoreline of Lake Superior. Now this material is with the discussions that have happened as a result of an EPA Phase 1 award to a company, LessTech, they have done outreach to Certain Teed, Owens Corning, John Mansfield, and, the asphalt shingle people, and they seem to be very interested in using these copper mine tailings, essentially taking them from the shoreline and in a plant that will be breaking them into even smaller particles, but they're already mined, they're already small particles. They need to have some coating, and that work has already been done. The reason I bring up this example, my visit up there was to meet with a number of angel investors who have been putting in $50,000, $70,000 into this project, and with that, they're also looking possibly at some partnerships with asphalt shingle manufacturers. But the missing is there really is not any venture capital interested in, or at least that I've seen, interest in this kind of technology. And in my previous discussions with VC, the opportunity to try to work with SBIR companies, I think is a missed opportunity among a number of venture capital. It's not right for every company. It's not right for every VC, but the opportunity of putting in, say, $1 million into a phase two company and leveraging that with $1 million of SBIR phase two funding will give you a lot of flexibility in terms of how you would proceed into the future. It tends not to be the $5 million or $10 million investments at the time of an SBIR award. The companies that we have funded SBIR awards that have later received venture capital, mostly they're receiving the venture capital because of technologies they've received, that they've developed, that do environment and energy, or do environment and other aspects of that make them interested in solar power or fuel cells or other technologies. But I think the SBIR program does have a place for certain kinds of venture capital, and I would hope that you'd look for it. You can find our website, look at some of our awards, and we can, if you have trouble finding the environmental awards in amongst all of the NSF projects, we have listings of some of their environmental phase two awards that we're tracking and working with NSF on trying to help them commercialize their technology. So
Jim, I'm going to stop you, and we're on the slide with your contact information, and I'm going to ask if anybody on the phone has a question. But while you're thinking about a question, let me just say, in the room here, you have a sheet of paper on the left side of your folder which has the connects the dots between EPA and all the NSF proposals. There's a one-pager. This is from the website. Those of you online, this is one of the supplemental materials, and basically it maps, Jim and his staff have mapped green buildings NSF topic this and greenhouse gases into NSF topics. So on the left side of your blue folder here in the room, you should have an SBIR opportunities, and that's the mapping to NSF. On the phone, it's mounted on the extra materials that are supplemental materials. Does anybody have a question for Jim, or we're going to push on? Okay,
Keith, make quick comment. I've worked for the
National... Keith Crandall.
Yes, Keith Crandall from Arch. I also serve on the board of the National Venture Capital Association. I'm on governmental affairs there. Since 2003, investor-backed companies where the investors own collectively more than 51% have been precluded from participating in the SBIR program. And given that most of these projects that are involving commercializing environmental technology take upwards of $10, $20, or $30 million ultimately to commercialize, that effectively precludes a large sector of a very needed input, both in experience and capital, from participating in the SBIR program. So
I thought they had rethought that.
Well, there's a Senate and the House version of the bill. I think the House version is the right kind of enlightened, progressive type of legislation we'd all like to embrace. And the Senate is, I think, working very diligently to protect the small companies in Massachusetts that get just about all their funding from the SBIR program.
Let me just make one quick response to your comment, because I think it is true that the Senate and House reauthorizations of SBIR, both of them seem to be offering with a group called Biotech, a venture capital, mostly in the health related fields. I think the next reauthorization of SBIR will allow companies to have ownership of venture capital as well as others. So it's going to open up the door for venture capital, but I think the real question is are there going to be venture capital in the area of environmental projects that would like to participate? So far, we have not seen a lot of venture capital involved in our SBIR projects, nor do we see that really at NSF. And I think both NSF and EPA are going to be welcoming the change in the law when it probably will take place in the next couple of months, certainly before the end of the calendar year. and it's going to open up SBIR to, or companies that have venture capital funding to be eligible for SBIR funding.
Not that the Congress is working on anything else right now, of course, but health and greenhouse gases and so forth.
Right, but if you haven't seen it since 2003, there's probably a reason associated
right.
with that, which is that we were precluded from participating.
Right. So. Okay, we're going to press on to the other, since most of you are very knowledgeable, but we thought it was important to highlight this connection with NSF. One thing that most investors I've met with don't know about is that we have an environmental technology verification program, and Teresa Harton and Maggie Thoreau in Boston, I think, are going to be backing her up. We're going to talk about that on her there. Teresa?
Okay,
Morning.
Hi, everyone. This is Teresa from Cincinnati. And as Walt said, we have this environmental technology verification program at EPA. And what we do is test new environmental technologies at the commercial ready stage to provide third-party objective information about how they perform to help them get over that valley of death so that they can use the information from EPA reports that are credible with investors and purchasers, policymakers and regulators and so on to help sell the technology. So we do have those client groups that we see, the purchasers, that the information helps purchasers decide to buy technology, and it helps facilitate permitting. That's another hurdle that new technology, environmental technology, has to get over because regulators are often risk-averse. They don't want to go with new technologies. They don't know how well it works, so they want to go with the sure thing. So we help provide the confidence in the new technology. And, of course, I mentioned that the vendors and developers of these technologies use the information or reports to sell their technologies. And lately this group, you guys, venture capitalists and other financiers of technology, have used the information to make further investments in the technology to help them get to the marketplace and help them get into production, mass production and into the marketplace. Next slide. ETV at a glance, just some key points about ETV. We've been in existence since 1995, and we've tested 407 technologies and developed 90 testing protocols. This is a whole array of environmental technology areas, drinking water treatment, wastewater treatment, air pollution control, greenhouse gas technologies, all kinds of monitoring technologies, and we've recently opened up an ETV center for remediation and recycling materials management technologies to sort of take the place of the old site program many of you may be familiar with, maybe not, that was under Superfund and was discontinued a couple years ago. But so we do go across the whole range of entire environmental technologies. And we have over 300 stakeholders active in advisory groups, so this helps make the program very relevant, where we get folks from academia, from the regulatory community, developers, trade associations, all sort of advising our ETV centers on what technologies to verify and how to test them, what criteria to use in testing them. So make sure that those are the types of data that the purchasers and permitters and others are going to want to see in the technology. We also have a lot of collaboration going on. The program was started with all EPA money in 1995, but was supposed to go self-sufficient. I mean, it was designed to go self-sufficient with the vendors and developers of technology paying the full price of verification. Well, that hasn't happened. We see that there's other parties who are interested in information, other parts of the federal government, trade association and states help pitch in and pay for these verifications. And in years 2004 to 2007, we were at about 50% leveraging, and that really jumped up in 2008 to 80%. And we don't have the figures in for 2009 yet, but I think it'll be close to that same 2008 figure. And then we also produced a case studies document where we looked at 15 technology categories that we had been verifying and looked at the outcomes for those, where what impact did we have on vendor sales, what impact did we have on pollution reduction. And we didn't always have the data, but we made projections based on how big the market was and a certain market penetration and so on some of these things. But for some of the case studies, we did have actual information and actual data on some of these things. And I have a case study at the end that is a snapshot of one of those. And our website's very active. We believe in transparency, so all of our test plans go up on the web and all of our reports go up on the web. All of our stakeholder meeting minutes are up on the web. And we do track about 1.5 million hits a year, and you can see there our website address. And then we're going global as well. We've been working really hard the last three, four years with other countries who have ETD programs. They're not as well funded, or they're not funded, that's not the right word. They're not as strong as our program. They're not as productive in terms of verification as our program. And some of them are just getting off the ground. ETB Canada is out there. The Europeans have pilot programs going on, and they're going to have a full-scale program in the offing. They've got to get all the countries to vote on it, though. Korea's got a program. Japan's got a program. And the Philippines has a program. And some of these programs we are formally involved with to develop an international approach to ETB, where there would be recognition across countries for each other's programs. So that would help vendors. They wouldn't have to be verified in each country. And so that's, we think, another attractive feature of the program to the vendors especially. The last slide I've got is a case study for the drinking water treatment area, where we've been verifying new membranes, microfiltration and ultrafiltration membranes, for the removal of microbial contaminants. And we looked at the market, and we think there's up to 2,200 small drinking water systems that need to meet EPA's new rule. And there you can see the name of that rule. Short name is LT2, and that's a conservative estimate. The 2,200 is a conservative estimate. That's the small drinking water treatment systems, which we mostly focus on in ETV. But these systems often can be scaled up. They're modular and can be scaled up for larger systems. In fact, Pittsburgh is an example that we use here. And we have already looked at 3 microfiltration and 6 ultrafiltration membranes. They were verified. And we found that the city of Pittsburgh used the results to purchase a full-scale system, and they declared a savings of $5 million over conventional treatment and using these membranes. And then also we have shown savings in pilot testing, so it's not just the technology itself that is a way of purchaser saving, but also there's not as much pilot testing that needs to be done. So we did some projections at 25% market penetration for 550 systems, that is. There would be $1 to $8 million in pilot testing savings. And there would be 2,700 to 13,000 cases of cryptospora
diosis.
Thank you. Yes, per year, and avoiding that would avoid up to 2 deaths per year. Just that's the projection, and we would realize economic benefits from health savings, other health savings as well, from $2 to $19 million a year. And we're also in the middle of, or at the very tail end, really, of verifying 4 of these membranes, 4 new membranes, and the reports for those are going to be out in the fall of this year, and probably next month.
Okay. Yes, we're ready for questions right now.
Is there any work that you guys have funded for point of use on this type of new membranes and filtration, or is it mostly at the treatment facility level?
Well, we have point of entry work that we did, so for more like for commercial buildings, not for residential. Usually, it's for commercial buildings. So yes, we have done work there.
Yes, if you're talking about a commercial a hotel, right, or a apartment
right.
House, something like that, right?
Well, my interest is more on the consumer side. So
okay.
Yeah.
All right. On the phone, questions. The ETV website's there. The case studies are there. I don't know, those of you may not frequent Water Environment Federation, Air Pollution Control Association conferences, but vendors put our reports out on the table because they think it will help
get over that dry lab problem that people think they have with environmental technologies. So, thank you, Teresa. Alan Waltz is up next. This is how you can use your company, companies could use enforcement programs to get a first use, a first trial, a first demonstration. It's called Supplemental Environmental Projects. So,
I'd like to do this very quickly so we can gain some time. But just wanted to highlight that it's not a program. It's not probably as significant in terms of resource as the other areas we've been talking about. But there are some significant opportunities in terms of our enforcement program that would provide a way to demonstrate new technologies. And although they're in the context of enforcement action, these go beyond compliance requirements. So there are ways to get us past the question that Walt highlighted before of establishing best technologies and kind of being stuck with that. It's a way to demonstrate better pollution control technologies and raise the bar. So I'm going to the next slide there.
That's why and when.
I have a few bullet points on EPA step policy. Most importantly, there's the website there. There are some requirements, some legal requirements in terms of when a step can be employed. Largely based on there being a nexus between the step and the violation, which means there have to be environmental benefits accruing to the same population and or area that was impacted by the violation and defines acceptable types of projects. So I encourage you to look at that policy. When a step is agreed to, it is documented in a settlement document, either administrative settlement or civil settlement, and so then EPA monitors how that step is carried out. I also want to highlight that many steps also have their own state step policies, which often can be more lenient in terms of the nexus requirements and so on, so there are additional opportunities there. Next slide. To give you a sense of the magnitude of resources that go into SEPs, in 2007, $3 million, 2008, $39 million. I don't have 2009 figures yet, but it'll be comparable to that. The categories of SEPs are outlined in the policy as the SEPs we encourage. I want to highlight three as being particularly relevant here. Projects to further reduce pollution, projects to prevent pollution, and environmental compliance promotion. That one is really where we try to encourage companies who are testing out a new technology to then turn around and talk to other facilities in their sector. So it's a way of disseminating information on new technology. And then I want to highlight a significant limiting factor, which is that EPA can encourage but cannot require steps. So a company may find it more advantageous just to reach a settlement, pay the penalty, and move on. Reaching a SEP does require some more negotiation to work out the terms of the SEP project, and so there are some limitations there to be aware of. Next slide. So where is the market? How do you figure out when a SEP opportunity is coming up, which is really the challenge here? EPA has tried to address this issue by developing banks of project ideas. So there are a list of ideas on EPA's SEP website that are available. And if you want to look for opportunities to test a new technology in the field, a very good way of doing so is, as one of your many outreach and marketing efforts, is to submit that technology as a project idea to EPA, and then we have it in our pocket and kind of suggest it to companies in appropriate situations. Another way to identify the market for this kind of way of testing technology would be to look at our national and regional enforcement priorities. And I give you the website there to find those priority areas. And that's where a significant amount of our penalty recovery generally comes from, particularly for air and water. And the last slide lists some examples of innovative technology steps. So we've had steps that promote green building practices, sustainable water infrastructure, carbon capture, solar roofs, energy investments, water filtration, which could certainly include end of life, and then a few examples of steps from the past that were sort of institutionalized as technology practices through being tested in the SEP arena. One is diesel retrofits, another is wood stove buybacks, and then small engine replacement. All of those technology approaches gained a lot of traction from being used in the SEP context, and now are routinely used as SEP projects as well as through different stewardship programs of the
NCS. I don't work in enforcement. I'll turn this around as an example. So Alan goes out at the state of Wisconsin and finds a pulp and paper discharger who has too much mercury going into the stream. They say, you're right, I did it. We negotiate a fine of $100,000 or $150,000. At that moment when we're doing that, if some company were to arrive and advise that company they could get the mercury out cheaper, faster, better, the company who's signing up with us could say, oh, gee, I'd like to divert a proportion, it's a controlled portion of the amount, say $75,000, using a slipstream of my waste and try out the new technology to get the mercury out. And we could supervise that work under the consent agreement. And the trick is it doesn't have to work. That is, the technology could be tried out. Maybe it didn't achieve the result. The company's not off the hook for future compliance, but the person with the new technology got a chance to try it out at the pulp and paper waste stream. So that's the whole, we don't, so Alan's point is we don't market other people's technologies. They're on the bank, or if I were a smart company that had mercury removal, I'd go find all the people who have mercury problems and find out whether Wisconsin and EPA were chasing them down. So the vendor or your vendor has to make the connection.
Could you share that information? Is that available to the public?
Well, he showed you the two sets of information.
I'm sorry. Did
they were fine in your example.
Yes.
Then that's publicly available.
Then it's done. Yes. Once we sign the agreement, it's over,
okay.
Right?
Yeah, well, one thing that is publicly available is that we initiate a formal administrative or civil enforcement action. That we publish that information. So you could monitor EPA's website for press releases in terms of enforcement actions that we've initiated.
Okay. One other question on that. So after they've paid the fine, what is the recommendation then for them to comply?
It's up to them.
So they could just wait for another fine and do nothing?
Well, in terms of returning to compliance, when we do a settlement, we'll require the return to compliance along with the incurred penalty and recovered economic benefit. Where the SEP comes in is when the company says, all right, we're doing all this to return to compliance. We think we can do even better and perhaps even escape this regulatory scheme altogether by having more pollution reduction and pollution prevention. And we want to try that out, or we want to gain additional environmental benefits by trying this out as well as returning to compliance.
On the phone, are there questions about this? This is great.
Yes, there is one question. This is Phil Hurd at Cimarron. Just curious, there are state environmental departments are very involved in either the SEP or the tech verification programs, and if encouraging them might lend some value.
I can't speak to the tech verification, but in terms of state SEP policies, EPA in the past has generally not gotten heavily involved in what those SEP policies should look like. We, kind of put our SEP policy out there and try and share information on it, but each state is largely left to its own devices in terms of how it defines its SEP policy. We don't do a lot of legwork to encourage the use of SEPs in state enforcement programs.
Some have a less of a nexus than ours, as you pointed out, right?
They each make their own legal analysis for what they have to do to be able to provide this kind of approach. But we don't have a history of doing that. What we do have a history of is, if we identify something that would be potentially a good SEP project, we will try and share that information with the state. But that's more of an informal information sharing rather than sort of a pushing a particular policy approach.
Yes,
one more question. For the SEP program, can you give an opinion about an approach or a technology before it's ready for submission to your program to help us, in our case, understand if this is worth pursuing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if there is a particular technology that you want to be considered in the SEP context, you could send it to me in Region 5 or my counterpart in any region, the enforcement director, and I'll share it with the relevant programs and kind of put it on their radar and let them look at it.
Give us an opinion if this would meet the requirements we have, or no, we tried this before and it failed, or whatever.
Yeah, we kind of gather that type of input. The point, though, to keep in mind is it's often difficult to provide that kind of feedback up front because so much of what determines whether a particular technology is suited is going to be the specifics of the case and whether it actually has a nexus in resolving any kind of environmental problems that were created in that case. But what we do, because of that sort of need for case-specific information, we add it to our SEP bank so that if it passes the lab test, and it looks like it would be potential pollution reduction and pollution prevention technology, we make that information available so that folks can look at it when those specific cases come up and then encourage it, consider it in that context. And that's the point at which you probably would get feedback. That might not be immediate feedback.
Yeah, to be specific, just to put a point on that, you wouldn't get a reaction as to whether we think that technology will solve the problem, right? Because that has to do with vendor claims and the whole verification.
Sure.
This has to do with, do we face enforcement actions to get mercury out? You have one example of our needs, and mercury is needed to tighten down. So that might come up in the course of a case or an enforcement action.
I'm just thinking of things where, you know, before it's ready to submit, say, an SBIR, and you're trying to get some information about, you know, the trends that are occurring, the problems that you're seeing, you know.
Yeah.
And
exactly. Yeah,
that's
right.
Just to break down or to open the communication channels between the scientific community and the enforcement, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that I can still say.
Okay, cool.
Others on the phone or in the room? Okay, we're going to move on to the, we're taking rolling breaks here. I hope people will go and take a bio break or get coffee as we need it. We're going to keep going. I have one slide that basically has to do with your homework, if I can put it that way. We sent you 2 days ago or so several things, and one was a set of needs. I'm going to the slide that has the light bulb on it, and the next one after that, right, has what I'm going to say about needs, I think. Yes. What we sent out in advance, so I'm not going over each one of these needs by one. This is the part where we begin the feedback, the main meal of this at this restaurant. Is we compiled here in Region 5 a set of needs, and you have that with a light bulb publication of 22 different needs that are organized with Teresa's help and the ETV program, some that are near commercial ready, and a description of those, a set of technologies that are mitigation, treatment, and remediation related, some needs that are related to measurement and monitoring, and then we have a person here actually from headquarters who helped us draft a recent need that we're going to certainly relates to the Great Lakes on ballast water disinfection, a huge market to try and get keep invasive species from further invading the lakes, the Great Lakes. So that's what you have. They range, if you look through them, from very specific, like having a in-situ real-time monitor for Microcystis bacteria on the beaches, so we can take the sample today and decide to close the beaches today instead of taking a sample today, running it overnight, and decide we need to close the beach yesterday for the sample we took today. Some very specific needs, and then there's some much broader needs related, for example, to sediment remediation. There's 400 million yards of sediment that are going to be cleaned in the next 20 years, and so there's a whole range, as you see. We also had partnered up with our colleagues in Region 6. They had had a similar meeting to this earlier this year, and so they happily gave us the needs. They had developed more on a thematic basis. Those were more organized, broader statements, and they're on the phone with us from Region 6. And then I mentioned earlier that Sandy Concello is here, and we had a great meeting with General Service Administration, since environmental and clean tech have to do not just with pollution control and pollution prevention, but also with green buildings and energy generation, and they've supplied five or six needs that they see coming down the road for the same region. GSA has the same region in these six states. They manage a portfolio of buildings across this whole region. They build buildings and they rent buildings and they are owners and operators. So they have a lot of interests that relate to energy and so forth. So that's really my introduction. The questions that I've teed up for Bob Savage and Ira Weiss and Keith, just to get us started, and then I'm hoping we'll go from the phone to the back to the room, and others are there's questions that are at the bottom of the page. There's a fundamental question about whether we should take the time to do this. Does anyone care whether EPA and GSA in your community figure out some needs and articulate them and give you the name and phone number and email addresses of the people sitting behind us here in the room and other places? And secondly, if it is, if that turns out to be a yes, how should we do that? We're not going to call a meeting like this every 6 months, but how is it that you would process such information? And also, I skipped over the step of
maybe we didn't get the needs right. I mean, maybe there's something about you like the thematic needs or the specific need or so forth. So I'd ask Bob, Ira, and Keith for 5 minutes or less each just to tee up that question. And Bob, you're leading off. Bob is a fund manager for Rocket Ventures and a managing partner for Core Network in Toledo.
All right.
You're up to bat.
Walt. Okay. Thanks, Walt. I think this is helpful. I run here both a seed state technology fund, which is a private-public partnership, and an angel network here. They both have a little different missions and a little bit different interests. I think we have invested in environmental companies, so not many of them. And they're certainly not one of the hot sectors, at least that, you know, I see in the venture, sort of what rightly or wrongly called the venture community in this region. Of course, bioscience and IT and alternative energy / clean tech get more press. And although environmental does fit into clean tech, many of the projects I think described in here don't fit into what most venture folks who invest in clean tech think of. Now that varies a lot by firm and is no different than early stage investing. If you know, if you ask the folks here even on the call how early they go, and you've got folks here that probably go earlier on average than most venture firms. But that varies a lot too. I think making the information available is definitely helpful, and you know, some kind of newsletter, email update, whether it be listserv, at least on a quarterly basis probably makes sense, and a meeting maybe more often. I mean, I think you've got folks, Arch, for one, and Keith, you know, obviously let him speak for himself, goes pretty early, and they have a vast array of technology they invest in. This is an area where they may be interested in fairly regularly or more often. You've got other investment groups that may look at this once in a while, but really not that often. And so you've got some folks who are more apt to read the newsletters and the a lesser amount who are apt to come to the meeting. I think just having this meeting is helpful. I think it's good to hear about the transparency in the agency is helpful as well. I think one of the things, you know, the case study that was pointed out a little while back, I think is helpful. And even beyond that, showing, I think, because what you really want to do, at least from an investment perspective and to attract more money in here, is to show companies that started here that were successful investments. Because I think if you ask most investors who have not invested in the environmental part of clean tech, you know, whether they want to or not, I don't know how much interest you get. Now, on the other hand, you show them 3 or 4 case studies that did well from a financial perspective and then ask the question, you get a different answer. So part of this is probably help, you know, doing a little bit of missionary work and educational work and showing that there are opportunities out there. And then I think assembling a lot of the folks that you like, the ones that are participating today, and actually getting input from some of them on, you know, what type of information goes out and how it goes out is helpful too. Am I reading correctly that the Region 5 needs, is that the page that says GSA Region 5 Venture Capital Initial Proposals at the top?
No, the one that from EPA has a light bulb on the front, all black cover, and has 4 more pages of 22 needs on it.
Gotcha. Okay.
The one that had the in-situ microcystis is about 5 technologies down on the first page. The sediments is about on the second, third page.
Yeah.
The GSA is here as well. Yes, they contributed, but then you asked me about what EPA produced, so that's what we produced.
I'm sorry, I had initially looked at the wrong one. I think that I think that this is, you know, just in a quick glance, this is certainly something that's helpful, and getting, you know, I think a little bit of this will just take some time to learn, you know, which of these types of technologies, you know, really lend themselves more to venture investing. And but I think that, you know, certainly looking at the SBIR programs and other grant programs is something that makes sense as well, because you'll get some of the, I mean, you can put out the list like this, and you get some of them that the venture folks may glom onto initially, and you'll get others that maybe, that might not really be a fit and might not be a tremendously scalable business, and others that might be a little bit too early for someone to glom onto right now. Not necessarily meaning that they're not good technologies or maybe don't fit, but they're, you know, you get a firm that even wants to look at a lot of these, there's only so many they're going to do at a time.
Plus, it may not be a big enough market. Well, let me turn to Ira. Thank you. Let me turn to Ira. You can have more airtime. We'll come back. But Ira, Weiss, you're in the room. So.
Thank you. So I'm going to, I know that Keith is going to talk about it from a VC perspective, so I'll talk more about it from an angel perspective. And the first thing I want to say is that I actually do think articulating the needs is really important. And I was telling Walter earlier, I was looking down the articulation of needs, and there was one about wireless sensor technology, and I realized, well, I've invested in a portfolio company that has technology that probably could be useful for this. So to some extent, you know, I'm not, you know, the information came to me. I hope my portfolio company knows about this, and there's a reason they haven't told me yet, but if not, I'll talk to them about it. But I do think articulating the needs is a great step. To the extent that there could also be information about the market size, maybe the number of facilities, the more information about the market, the better. So that's kind of my first point. Now, putting my angel hat on, one of the challenges is when you're a venture fund, you see something that looks neat, you see a really large market, you've got enough money that you could actually bring in a management, pay to bring in a management team, find the right people and bring them in, kind of match them together. From an angel perspective, you really need to find, I mean, I feel like we have to find the right angels. You have to find people who are entrepreneurs in the space and kind of jump, you know, I've done quite a bit of medical, well, not quite a bit, but a bit of medical device investing, and I have a couple people who are kind of entrepreneur and I would say kind of junkies in the space, and to the extent that you can find people who are serial entrepreneurs who start companies like this over and over, and you know, a venture firm would develop a stable of these people, but I think from the EPA's perspective, knowing who those people are and having a dialogue with those people, this is a good forum to help identify those people. So that's, I mean, the angel problem is, you know, we may have some money to put in the company, but there needs to be more there than just the articulation of needs. There needs to be someone who can bring that and move the idea forward. And generally, angels don't have enough capital, even as a group, to necessarily take an interesting need, go find a management team and put it in. Now, you know, usually when an angel invests, it doesn't necessarily need a whole management team, but there does need to be a person or two or three people who are going to be moving it forward. So when I looked at this, I thought to myself, well, this is really helpful for my one portfolio company and also for small companies out there that may be playing in the space already. But that's kind of my angel hat.
Good. Just for general information, we wanted to be able to talk directly with a few of you, and we're doing that. And we're actually cloning this meeting and repeating it in October for universities, engineering societies, engineering professors, and others to talk about the needs to the people who actually write the ideas. But if I call a meeting like that for the EPA, we'll have 50 people on the phone, and I will never hear from you because all the universities think we have money. Right? So I'm here to really hear from. We're here to hear from you. So Keith, yep. You get a chance here.
First off, let me thank the group for taking the time to come together and talk about this topic, because I think that's probably the most important first step that needs to occur. My sort of working assumption here is that the EPA is interested in having investor-backed companies involved so that they have a broader array of new technology, that they can newer, lower cost, quicker, faster, better to have various folks that aren't meeting regulations choose from in order to
meet those regulations. And if that's not correct,
that's right.
It's going to be off.
That's why we're here.
Right. So one of the challenges that we have as investors going into a regulated market, and this is the same for medicine and others, is that there is a long time to market for new technologies, and the timing is uncertain. So anything that can be done to decrease the uncertainty and shorten the time, I think will fundamentally do a lot to increase the amount of interest from the venture community. There are a number of aspects of this. When I look at that needs assessment or the needs that have been distilled down by various folks, if I come up with one good idea that comes out of that that's worth pursuing for our company, then that's a really worthwhile exercise for me to have read those several pages, because good ideas are actually relatively few. For me, understanding new research on health issues that have surfaced and pushing those out where you can't say the regulations are going to change tomorrow, but it's pretty clear that if a herbicide that people thought was toxic at a ppm is actually or has some toxicity is actually a challenge at a ppb, then that's something that we understand is going to be important and can move on. So the more information about those emerging health threats, that helps us define the market needs and allows us to do a better business case sooner. Also, if we understand, it also tells us about the severity of it. And again, one of the, having looked at water technologies over a period of, extended period of time, I will say that, in the United States, there's a lot of clean, well-fed, polite, college-educated folk that get up every day, drink the water, and do perfectly well. So in terms of a mission-critical failure, those are the types of things that are happening in certain parts of Asia and certainly every day in Africa. So while we are excited about improving the quality of our water, it's not clear how quickly people will pay in this country to get to those new levels, where there may very well be other issues that are much more mission critical in a sense, or life and death decisions elsewhere. And the problem with those folks is they generally don't have the money pay for the thing. So there's a bit of a challenge there. A couple other quick observations. One is, as you, I think, Walter, point out, the EPA is not the national lab system. So you don't have 12 or 15 facilities that have $1 billion in research. And I think that hurts the process, frankly. I think if there was a stronger research component at the EPA, that would speed the process of commercializing the applications, both because the EPA would be intrinsically aware of the capabilities and have internal verification. Second, that they would basically form a better partner to communicate with on these projects. And I think that's a is an important aspect of this. And I don't know whether the best way to do that is to partner more closely with existing other agencies that have the resources or to just fund a dedicated effort. My reaction would be that you probably want a dedicated effort if you're going to be serious about working in that area. The third point I would make, and it's a subset of this research point, is that many of the challenges that we're looking for solutions here are actually material science problems, kind of in drag, for lack of a better descriptor. If you have an issue with a certain set of bugs that are a potential health threat, and you don't want to use a mercury-based deep UV lamp, you do have other alternatives. And one of those is to use a deep ultraviolet solid-state light source, like a 265 nanometer LED. We all know that LED technology is with white and red, green, blue, is tens of billions of dollars now and ramping dramatically. If you had a LED technology that was in the deep ultraviolet, you could expect the same scale and the like. And why is it that we don't have that? And the reason is that you can't put the emitters in that space are aluminum nitride or gallium nitride based, and you basically can't put that material system onto the substrates, sapphire and silicon carbide, that are used today in the existing LED markets. So what you need is a substrate that allows you to make a chemistry in that deep ultraviolet. So I guess I would say that, you know, as you'd expect, and probably rightly, there's plenty of issues that the EPA can put out, or river fires that the EPA can put out today, and spend all of its, you know, resources doing that. I would say a lot of the bigger benefits that are going to accrue are actually going to, you know, there's no shortcut here. If somebody's not funding that basic science to solve some of these critical kind of grand challenges, then you're going to be stuck in an incremental mode, and I think that's compounded a little bit by this best available technology
statutes
as well. So,
great. That's a great teeing those up. Can I turn to someone on the phone? How about anybody north of Chicago? Do I have anybody takers in Minnesota or Wisconsin who want to make a comment on the need statement? All right. How about east of Ohio? Phil, you're in Baltimore if you're still with us, or
any
reaction?
Just thought that all of these have been great comments, and what occurs to me, having actually sat in a state environmental agency for a few years, is how out of the loop on these types of issues a state agency can be. So I would just, when you're thinking about how to create more dialogue, I would think about whether or not your state partners can help energize that activity to be of some use.
Okay.
That might be on the advisory end in the environmental technology verification program, or any brainstorming to identify needs or get them in place, get these technologies in place sooner.
Actually, there is some effort in the last 2 or 3 years. There's an organization called the Environmental Commissioners of the States that the state commissioners belong to, and they have a technical arm, and there was some effort in the 2004-05 area to talk, before everybody's budgets went south, to talk about environmental technology needs, but they, like we, were getting squeezed, they more than we, on just doing the basics in the last couple years, but there is some, we haven't forgotten them, for sure. How about in the room here? Anybody from On My Venture, John?
Sure. So I guess a couple comments I'd make. One is I find it very useful to be involved in this, and I'm very appreciative of seeing it. Sort of reminds you sometimes you're not quite as deeply and well connected in certain places as you'd like to be, and in contact with as many people as you sort of thought you were and maybe weren't with respect to human agency. But and whereas it's probably less likely that you're going to see something in that kind of material and decide that you found something fundable, it is very helpful in just sort of informing you about your views on the space. I think we tend to sort of have ideas about where we're focused, and as a result, I think some of the programs that we've had tremendous value out of has been the ETV and the validation program, and the case studies are profoundly useful. They're very helpful in sort of developing thoughts on process economics for particular states that we're aimed at. I'd love to see them once they involve situations we're involved in which case we'd probably rather they may not be there. But in any event, they're terribly helpful, and having access to those are great. I guess maybe what would even continue to better inform our perspective on the space, random example, arsenic remediation is an example where we've had interactions with developers. Access to some of those kinds of materials, maybe better connection with the people in the back row and better connection with the people in the technical advisory group. So if we know we've got a perspective on arsenic remediation or on reuse of particular categories of effluents, I need to do a better job, and this is a helpful sort of starting point, of connecting with the particular people in the advisory panels that were involved in those case studies. That were helpful in developing perspective on process economics and being in direct contact. And again, it just helps inform inform us and makes it more likely that we're going to get past mental hurdles and decide to make more commitments as opposed to less. So I find this very helpful. And, you know, again, maybe in future interactions, we'd aim more at getting to know better people in the background.
Yeah, their phone numbers are all in the needs, of course. And I guess you're saying about if I understood you right, the ETV has all these stakeholders who work out the protocols, for example, the arsenic treatment of water, and that includes state health commissioners and local officials and others. And being able to talk to them is what you'd look them up to talk about and chat with them. Or participate with them. Okay.
Yep.
I know Teresa may have not still be on, but Maggie Thoreau is on for her. She has your number. So that's an idea. Back to here in the room.
I had just a thought. I mean, on the SBIR program, that is great if you already have something that has made it out or has some personnel attached to it, and you can, you know, sort of the point that I was making, like it's sort of a pre-company angel setting. But I think what might be interesting, too, is in addition to that, support for some public-private gap fund that would prepare things for that stage, because that, to me, has been, in our work, the real valley of death, that it can't even cross over to being ready for SBIR yet. And I think that there's a lot of very interesting technology that could find its way out of research and would allow you, to Keith's point, to leverage those research assets more effectively if you could just sort of nudge it along a little farther. And one question I know that I had is that when you get excitement around an idea, applying for an SBIR grant, waiting for the results of that can make or break killing moving forward on something. So sort of something maybe smaller scale that's speedier, getting it out, or sort of a streamlined process for asking for, you know, similar amounts of money, but that could be applied to solving questions that will prepare things for the SBIR stage would be would solve a problem that we see currently. But I think this is tremendously valuable, and just the communication of this need, as to Ira's point, are really valuable. That definitely gives us some perspective, because a lot of times when you have the technology at that early stage, it's clay. You know, you could shape it into being this or that. And so knowing that you guys have already articulated a need in a certain area can help us in the shaping of it, too, which is very, very useful.
Your first point, I think you're raising a whole statutory issue. I mean, that's well beyond EPA to have a fund. I mean, we don't have that authority to have such a fund. I mean, that would be, and Jim Gallup's still on the phone, but I mean, that goes back to SBA and the whole SBIR thinking about what that's supposed to do.
Right.
Because to be honest, on the Hill, we are basically a regulatory agency.
Right.
I mean, we do have a research program, and you've acknowledged that maybe it needs to be more robust, but 9 times out of 10, the meetings are about regs we write and
right.
What we're doing, and so we try and have our research on the frontline problems that we're facing, whether it's endocrine disruptors or sequestration of CO2 or whatever's on our front burner, bed bugs, what's on our front burner right now. And but we're, as you said, we're not. So there's two different issues. One is we're not viewed as the technology development agency, and thus having authority to be a bridge would be a major step. Not impossible, but a major step.
I like also the leadership that you could provide if you identified an area, and then I like the matching component of what you're doing, because in lieu of a fund, if you had a grant program that required participation from industry or angels or venture or foundations to make your $1 turn into $2 or $3, that too would bring together the right intelligence and market forces that you need to break down some of those barriers getting stuff out. And so I said, for example, I'm excited about the program up at UWM, the one that is NSF-funded. I don't think it's DOE-funded, but it's the UWM Energy Technology Research Center that is a $700,000 or just shy of $1 million, but it's got federal, private sector, foundation money, and that kind of blended money. No, it's not WARP. It's a new program. It was just announced in end of August at UWM. And what it does is and then what they did was they carved out rights for the private companies that are participating in that to have to see a first look at licensing the technology. To me, that's a very exciting new kind of partnership that will help facilitate the flow into market of some of these technologies. What it does is it de-risks some of the investment opportunities for the venture community. So they know that, you know, few hundred thousand dollars has been put into this before they've got to put their own money into it, it helps to take some of the technology risk away and also proves to them that, you know, it's not just a science project. So I think that that is, looking at those kinds of programs and being maybe mindful of how maybe the SBIR program could participate in something like that, or how to, you know, break ground on a new program would be really exciting.
Well, thanks for that suggestion. We'll find out more about what it is.
I think that actually connects back to Keith's point about the need for communication between EPA and other agencies that are doing more basic materials research. While we might ourselves not have the statutory authority, we can, you know, advertise across federal agencies what our needs are and try and connect to some of these more fundamental research agencies that have more flexibility to do this public-private partnerships.
Yeah. And we are in, have some conversations going with Argonne since they're local, but that's
sure.
not a national effort.
Sure.
This is Jim Gallup. I think the link back to something like the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center, and maybe there's many of those around the country. In the SBIR program, we really try to work with state organizations that are interested in economic development and fostering companies to develop SBIR proposals. And I guess I would hope there's a way that that we can find links to these different institutions and make sure that they're aware of the opportunities in SBIR. I am sympathetic to your comment about how long it takes, and I think at least one of the things that we have found as a benefit of the collaboration with NSF is we work with them in their peer review. We actually sit on their peer review, so we see that they're able to do things in a faster way than we are at EPA. So, and they're able to do solicitations two times a year. So it's still, I understand how long it takes, but at least I think there's, in some ways, working with NSF could reduce the time maybe by half of what it takes with our single solicitation. But if there's something that we could do to try to do more in the collaboration with these university centers, then we'd really like to do it. Maybe we can have some further discussion about that.
Good. Thanks. Others on the phone or here? Something?
You know, I've got one other thought I'd just mention quickly, and that is in some of the emerging areas in things like food safety. You know, it seems like it's a very ripe area. You know, dioxane, for instance, is something the EPA has been worried about and focused on for a long, 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 long time, and rightly so. And I think the tests today are about $900 a test, basically, and that's done for drinking water. So it's not a particularly routine test when it is done. But, you know, with a lot of foodstuffs that are processed coming from other parts of the world, it would seem like there was a great opportunity for the EPA to share its experience and background to help develop better procedures and insights into things like dioxane and foodstuffs that are coming in, and I think a massive need to get the cost down and the and improve the speed of those types of tests. So,
and there's a nexus there, of course, with FDA. We set the tolerance for whatever it is we eat, and they check it at the border allegedly with customs. So it's you know, they would have to also be part of that kind of conversation, I think, but that's a good point.
Right. So I think there's from an investor standpoint, I think that could be a huge opportunity. Clearly, there's got to be some coordination of regs. Maybe that'll be driven by some type of a crisis.
Fortunately.
Maybe they always are. I don't know. You know, you mentioned about the river catching on fire. But I do feel like everybody's intuition is that this is an area that probably needs more scrutiny. I'm sure there are a dozen of those that people that are informed have, and to the degree there's ability to do reconnaissance in those areas and studies, not checking everything. You know, we don't have to,
right.
You know, perfect get in the way of better, but I think
right.
if you just took a month's worth of data on a particular set of suspect things and were able to present that, I think that would spark interest in those types of opportunities and perhaps precipitate the advancing of some regulation.
Actually, I think that we have what can serve as the bridge for you all. We're talking about building this synergy and partnership with other federal agencies. And if, for example, there is nexus and there are statutory differences, and yet we can work together from scientific perspective how we can leverage with each other. And one thing I'm sure that you may know, may not know, is working with the federal government, you mentioned about what about international market, in, because the drinking water in the in Asia and Africa is much needed, and yet they don't have money, right? And but if you look at it, some emerging market as opposed to developing countries, and using, if you would, government, working with the federal government, and we do have a commercial officer. This in, for example, emerging markets such as China, such as Brazil. And in China, for example, they are mandatory to build drinkable water in Beijing and through the Ministry of Water Resources. And we have State Department there, embassy there, commerce people there, environmental people there, agriculture people. They can all help you all. And to bring this drinking water technology over to China, not just because we make money. It's environmentally sound, too. So there's a partnership.
We have connections. I mean, I assume your companies may explore with Foreign Commercial Service in the past, the International Trade Administration, and all the parts of commerce that did outreach. We've actually done some joint efforts in the last administration overseas. So let me turn to another speaker.
Yeah, because AA, I think all of them are very useful, and I think this form here, I find actually very useful for what we do also. You know, being working with investors to small funds to large funds. But, you know, I guess what we have found is our experience with the independence that the EPA here is, there's money from the national labs or money from universities that basic research in terms of fundamental research. But we found with EPA in a couple of our specific examples is you guys actually have problems, you know, in your monitoring role, you actually have problems to solve and issues to actually deal with that are, I think, makes you different than some of the other agencies. And because of that, what's helpful is you have a fairly good, our experience is a fairly good handle on what the competing technologies are and what doesn't exist, and therefore what people like us can go out and technology we can bring to market where we actually know there's a use for. And we've had, you know, great experiences kind of walking through there. So the fact that, you know, what we get from the EPA, I think, is a more knowledgeable base on the commercialization side of what problems are really out there and need to be fixed. And quite frankly, our experience is there's incentive with the people within EPA to actually get that and push us in a couple of cases to get products, you know, to market even quicker than maybe what we would have otherwise. So it's not so much to us a lack of funding. There's fundamental research money available. We certainly have problems that need to be solved, nowhere to solve them. And, you know, in the case I'm talking about, it's kind of a testing and monitoring situation that you know you need to go to remediate that. But it's been very helpful to us and I think very useful. The more that we know and can communicate, figure out more of those needs and assessments, I think works wonderful for us.
If I could tease that apart a little bit, and this fits with something Iris said, I mean, the folks sitting here, for example, who named the mercury treatment technologies, that they're not in the plant. I think they're aware that pulp and paper companies or other kind of companies are having problems meeting that standard. And so I often argue in headquarters where I used to work, we're tertiary involvement. We don't actually ever touch a real company. Here we actually have folks who may go on an inspection or have talked to that company about their compliance problems. And then, of course, the states may actually be the one giving our partners. So which of those people you want to have a conversation, are you having conversations with, or how do you need, which of those phone numbers do you need to find? Because we're not studying the market in a sense, but we know at different levels of sophistication, state, regional, and national, what else is out there? I mean, this guy is explaining this well. How do we
involve in the work and support? I guess the point I was making before was there are a couple of cases that John was alluding to where we've been involved in the interactions with the ETB folks and going through validation processes and having interactions that have been profoundly valuable. And we might actually come to the table with a perspective on certain things and are developing thoughts on how we want to go about funding projects in a particular domain and interactions with the technical advisory folks that may well have sat behind some of the case studies that were generated is useful in that respect. So that's good. That's kind of what I was sort of getting at before.
Okay. Yep.
And we can have a feel for it, too, just kind of, you know, how big is the murder problem? I mean, is it one that it is kind of, anyway, if they're solvable, then you can do things about them. If they're not quite soluble, you can't quite get to the limits that you would like to have, then you work on them and that. So at any point in time, something's become a little bit more interesting to you, and, you know, in other times, knowing what that is at any point in time is very useful to us. And really the only way is to talk individually with people on the inside here to find out what that is. And what the real, you know, what really is important to you guys at this point in time.
Yeah, one more comment. The thoughts before, the questions before about the interactions with the university community are interesting and useful as well. And where the tire hits the road there and the contributions we make to that process today won't ultimately manifest for a long time. But you'd probably be surprised by the degree to which there's interaction now that's very deep between, you know, the Mark Shannons and the Seth Snyders and the people in this community that are top PIs in the space and very senior EPA people and EPA advisory people. And equipping us with thoughts about what's commercially interesting is useful, and it's great. It's good for us. Equipping those folks with very real-time thoughts about what's commercially useful and what has commercial scale is even more valuable, because whereas there is this perception that folks in the academy resist, inside up, our experience has been exactly the opposite. They're terribly interested in knowing what is worth spending time and effort on. And it's not just secondary and tertiary people and new people. Top PIs are terribly interested in having very relevant input about what's significant commercially, where should they focus. And so those interactions are quite useful, not with the administrators that are creating commercialization programs, but with the actual PIs that have access to significant grant funding and are steering the work they're doing on, you know, titanium dioxide and other exotic, you know, arsenic remediation, through next-gen arsenic remediation media. What should they aim that at? How should they aim that? What direction should they take the next 6 months' worth of work in? That, the influence of that ultimately leads to more disclosures that are more likely to result to have commercial outcomes. And I think that happened for a while, but that's where the tire hits the road.
Well, that kind of great suggestion is the reason we also postponed this meeting again for the universities and engineering societies and others that we're planning in October. So, yes, Ira, and then we'll go to the phone. So someone on the phone will take up a question after Ira makes his comment.
Sure, I just want to talk a little bit more about the market size, because
yes.
I know it probably would be really challenging for the EPA to say, look, this is how think we this is how many facilities.
Go back to my beach example. Let's take that.
Right? What example?
The beach example, right? We want something to be able to close the beaches today instead of tomorrow. How would we tell you?
Well, you could tell us how many locations are out there that. I don't know about would buy, but
well, that's the question.
You're giving me an example. I was going to take a different.
Sorry, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I interrupted you. I was.
But that is the question. So, I mean, there's two different levels. One is, okay, it would be great to know how many people would buy such a thing, which of course depends on the cost. But to some extent, the more information you can give about what the market is, such as, you know, there are, and I see it in here a bit. There are 4,000 facilities out there that are large enough that we track these facilities to make sure that these facilities are not. Polluting, I can't even describe what the pollution may be.
Right.
And these 4,000 facilities often have a problem with, you know, here's the need I was talking about. So that even saying 4,000 facilities, then if you describe what the facilities are like, the more you can, you know, as an investor, the more information you can get about what the market is. And you don't need to tell us, here's what the market is. You know, look, some of those facilities may buy it, some won't.
Right.
And that's going to be our judgment. But the more we can know about who those are that would be the most interested, because you're breathing down their back and they're willing to pay more for it, the easier it would be for an investor and effectively the entrepreneur to assess what the market opportunity is. So I just want to clarify, because I do actually think outlining the needs and connecting it to some way with the market size.
Size of users, at least.
Size of users.
I've lost control of the time, but these have been very. I'm going to go to my last slide here on the regs. Because one of the comments we heard at the, I'm going to this slide on the regulatory agenda, we got at this summit that we had, shall we go back to the reg agenda? Anyway, as I mentioned earlier, EPA puts out a listing of 150 pages twice a year with regulatory summaries on it, and it's quite extensive, and no one would read it except if they want to sleep soundly. So what we did is we actually the people in this room, Howard and Carol and others, went through and tried to extract regs that were on the regulatory agenda, which comes out twice a year, that actually seemed to foretell some technology angle. And out of 300 and some they screen, when you get through the ones that are new reporting requirements and tweaking this and tweaking that, at least as a working premise, we found about 14 that actually from the Air, Water, and Waste Program, that's what you got in advance. They cover a whole time spectrum, apropos of what Keith said, he had to catch a plane, but some of them are long-term regulatory actions. It means we're just thinking about this problem. For example, today we announced, or yesterday or the day before, I think 7 or 8 new drinking water contaminants that we're going to focus on over the next 10 years in order to crank down and decide what those limits ought to be. That's long-term, whereas these in this list you have are proposed regs that are going to come out in the next 6 or 8 months. Their final rules are completed rules. And so we have the same set of questions kind of to wrap up this meeting is this enough or is it useful? I mean, this is responding to this, what's going to happen in the future, not so much about the market. We are going to take some action on, and you have that in your pack as well in the future. So I don't know if Bob, you have a, did you have a chance to look at those, Savage, or for a reaction?
I did, yes. To back up on what Keith said, I think, you know, if there's a way through this agency or others to funnel more research here too, that would definitely be important. Also, on an item that Ira sort of brought up, if, you know, to attract investors, if you send this out, some of them who are really interested will dig through this. Others will kind of take a glance and see if there's anything they immediately glom onto. If there was a way to see the companies behind the technology, that would make it more interesting to investors, potentially a lot more interesting. And then one of the other challenges with probably most of this is getting is doing something to abate the investors' fear of the environmental sector being high, you know, fraught with red tape and regulation and long sales cycles.
Well, maybe have regulation. I don't know about the 10 years to market, at least for a lot of environmental technologies and remediation that I used to work with, is a kind of a standard. But when you say, could I just ask you what you meant? The companies behind the technologies, one of the technologies on here says that we're going to write a reg to crank down on at airports on, where is it?
Sure.
Antifreeze that's used to wash down planes, the problem of water pollution from antifreeze of planes. So that's a statement about some reg that's coming out. Are you saying you need to know who the companies are that sell wastewater treatment plants to treat that? Or what is it that
I wasn't looking at that one in particular, but there was one here that said the agency is testing for kits or potential options that may solve this need here. And what the investors would be interested in is, did this kit come from GE, or did it come from a university research lab or somebody in their garage, or what, you know, if there was a 2 to 3 paragraph synopsis of the founder's background or something like that.
So that's one of the reasons why the case studies are so interesting and useful, because they're very detailed descriptions of actual work going on at actual companies and what the specific commercial implications are and what their process economic parameters are. And, you know, granted, they're 18 months out of date or something, or a year out of date, but they're really useful and interesting for that very reason. It has all the sort of commercial backdrop, not just the
process. See on the slide, we put the names of the contacts up there, and by and large, these people know the answer to those questions, at least some of them,
right,
or can point you in the right direction.
Right on.
Anybody else on the phone that I can draw in on reacting to the reg digest, and whether it's, go back to Ira here, if you have any.
I do think it's really useful, and I guess I'm thinking about more from my, kind of healthcare investing, you know, kind of taking that over to this realm. I think one of the challenges is when it's, you know, if you're looking at it over a 10-year horizon, there's really so much, kind of a key thing, there's so much uncertainty about, like,
a 10-year horizon. Well, venture funds invest over 5 years and harvest for the following 5 years. So, like, even a venture fund that has an, you know, 5 to 7 year horizon is even at that horizon. But I do think laying it all out so that people can see, well, here's what they're thinking about. Here's what seems like it's going to be in place 5 years from now. And I think, you know, kind of the way that you put forth what the regulations are and talking about that horizon is useful. And bringing that back to, you know, here's what's going on within the next 1 to 2 years, I think is very useful, because then to the extent that you've, you know, invested in a company or are looking at a company, you know, you have more clarity and less uncertainty about whether something's going to be useful. So I do think it is very important. I think the challenge is just the time horizon. It seems like, you know, you don't know when. So much uncertainty about the time horizon.
Well, some of these, of course,
unless they're in place now, the needs now are, I think, extremely useful.
Some of these are final rules. That means in the next 6 months, this will be a requirement, which means it'll probably take effect in the next 90 days after that. And so that's an expression of, some would argue that's too soon, right, to start an investment to solve the antifreeze problem at airports.
Right.
And the other side is, well, that's good, then we know we're ready to go to market. So
I think that's very, but that's extremely useful. Like, here's when the regulations are coming out, you know, and that to some extent, you know, a lot of people have made a lot of money with, you know, a regulation's coming out, and once the regulation comes, people know that the regulation's coming out, and then someone's going to be in pain to make sure that they're able to take care of that,
right.
Take care of that problem.
Right.
Investors always look for that. And that's, you know, and especially healthcare investing, there's, you know, a regulatory change that happens with hospitals. It takes a long time for them to integrate technology, but if there's a regulatory change, boom. You know, they'll adopt things within a period of a month or 2 months because they know that they need to. So I think I think it's very useful.
Maybe one last point, I think.
Yeah.
A lot of these companies get started off based on technology or a lot of issues. You have to select your application areas. So, you know, for example, we have one that can detect lead and dust. That took 3 or 4 years to develop, which we started with. But in 6 or 9 months, we had the same device that was now able to detect lead in water. So water got much more interesting in the last 4 or 5 years than it was maybe 10 years ago when we were in there. So you don't need to start these things from absolute ground zero every time.
Mm-hmm.
There's technologies, the companies are 2, 3 years old that were put in place to do certain things here. It could very well, since you have that infrastructure, 6, 9, 12 months later, with the right guidance, you could go into areas that are much more interesting, too. So you can get the solutions much quicker than if you have to start from zero.
Dual use argument, right? Everything DOD pays for, hopefully you could use for sensing and monitoring.
If you can get it down to dual, you're lucky. And then you're going to have to find that you're going to have to develop. Hey, one more. Just to Ira's point about understanding kind of market size and what causes somebody not to gloss right over it, but to decide, I'm going to focus on that. And forgive me for that, keep coming back to the process of economics. So NREL has these published certain models, the economic models for particular processes, and the obvious case with ethanol, biofermentation facility, and sort of straightforward process economics, but there's 15 or 18 sets of them that you can very readily get to and use to define the scale. To understand the scale of a particular opportunity because of its impact on the process economics, and to publish some sort of make available some similar things across environmental applications like particular effluent reuse or applications or particular remedial applications would be helpful. And then to Iris' point, kind of translating that into, you know, here's a process model for doing arsenic remediation. And by the way, here's the magnitude of that market. So if you impact this variable cost by, you know, 2%, that translates into X dollars. That's where, you know, somebody can kind of very quickly get the idea of, oh, now I see why I should focus on that. Does that make sense?
Well, this is Region 6. We have to sign off. We've lost our room.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for being with us.
But
I don't think we do that. I mean, there are some cases where we've done pollution prevention studies and others, and you're talking about ETV. That's kind of the place where post-facto case studies are being done. But I don't think across EPA we are engaged in what DOE can afford to do, which is study the whole ethanol industry and we'll break out the 12 kinds of plants, and that we haven't done that.
One more small thing about the commercial-ready technologies. So I forgot to mention the idea of actually having a list of, you know, here's some smaller companies that are doing something in this space, which I think would be useful because then you can like find a company to go invest in. So if there are smaller companies that are doing it, if you have that list, that would be great. The other thing that's also useful for investors is a list of even the bigger companies that play in the space, if you're not so familiar with the space, because, an investor always thinks about what's the exit going to be, and typically, the overwhelming majority of exits are sales to a much larger company. And so to the extent that you see, here's a small company working on something, I see why this big company would be interested in it later, that's also something that's very helpful.
We have the problem, just to speak to that. Certainly the ETV folks, if you call that phone number, they'll tell you who they're testing. That's
okay.
No problem. We have a problem about picking people to tell you about, because we're a regulatory agency.
I understand.
So if there are 12 people in the market, we don't have a problem if there's only one person. We actually can send out the administrator and bless the new off-gas treatment technology. If there are 12 and we go in 11 of them, we have a problem. So that's not something we do. Robert can do that, and my colleagues at SBA can do that, but I can't do that. So I just offer that as a comment. But the people at ETV, of course, could tell you who the companies that walked in the door saying, we want to be tested for water treatment along with these four others. But to write something down that says, these are all the companies that do that, that's not something we can pull off, because we'll miss somebody, and then we have this using public office for private gain problem, which is our, But I understand why you want that.
Is there any way for people to, is there any way for companies to self-report that?
Sure. We have to think about that. I have to say sure in the sense that we have to avoid creating surveys. OMB takes a dim view of asking more than 9 people the same question. So that's a, but I don't want to sound negative. I mean, there's maybe a way to, but if you call the person working on that reg that you are interested in, that person can have a conversation with you about the companies that have contacted them, and then they're not either taking a survey, nor are they telling you those are the only ones. You see, there's a difference here between us portraying that. The one on ballast technology, the resource person sitting right behind you, he could probably tell you who the Coast Guard is going to test this spring in those demos, but there may be others out there, and that's a different question than having them all.
Well, for one concept there might be the idea of a clearinghouse. I don't know how it would work, but maybe gathering names of companies or submissions of names.
Well, in some ways, the bank of ideas, Kathy Schneider is still here for Alan Waltz, that you can list companies who offer that technology on the enforcement is still possible. And then that's an open season right now, right?
It's absolutely possible, and it's out there. You can search it. I know the state of Illinois has one, too. I think all the states in our region have them. And you can, when you're sitting there at your computer, start noodling around, see who has offered themselves doing these sorts of things.
Whether they work or not, or they're dry-labbed or not, is another question.
Right.
But that's,
and again, not comprehensive, just individual.
That is one way that we do clearinghouse things, and we do that for remediation in another way, but we don't do it across all of our programs. So. Anyone else on the phone with a view on stop putting together reg digests? Or I guess I'm getting a sense that it would have to be, well, it's something you'd read in 2 minutes and decide whether to use or not is what I'm getting a sense of the room. So we have to decide putting effort into it, do it twice a year, or have it on our website saying we updated it again this week. For example, this issue I just gave you, these new announcements about the 8, 7, 8, 9, whatever it is, chemicals that are going to be the focus of the drinking water program. That's probably interesting to people who are chemists and know about treatment technologies.
It is amazingly useful for someone who's working on the technology in the space. Companies that I've had up within, if it's out there, they know who to contact. They probably already have their contact, but having it out there and laid out the way that, it also validates it for an investor in some way, because you have someone that you may be investing in who says, look, this, the EPA is going to be looking at this, and here's what they're going to be doing, and regulating 3 to 5 years from now. And I'm like, well, okay, what kind of proof? Oh, well, I talked to this guy at the EPA, I talked to this person at the EPA, whereas if it's actually laid out there the way you lay it out there, then it's something that people can point to, and it does reduce the uncertainty, as Keith was saying, and it does increase the chance that you will get someone to invest in it. So I do think it is helpful.
So other comments on the regs or the needs?
Understanding where an issue is in the regulatory development process. If something is
still stuck in the basic toxicological evaluation. That's one thing. If it's gotten through IRIS and there's a standard associated with it, that's another. If some sort of practice has been defined, a best available practice, that's another. So where are these issues on the continuum?
Yes, good point. I could visualize doing this digest laid out on a calendar a little different, so you know that something's going to be final, apropos IRIS point. I mean, it's a visual thing almost. This thing kicks in December. These other are 3 years away, and these eight chemicals I just mentioned are not going to be regulated for 4 years. I mean, we can certainly, that's a packaging. I don't mean that in a simplistic way, but it's an arraying it in a different way. I understand that. Let me just summarize. I got the clear sense that in many cases, although several of you said the information we sent out is useful, that being the intermediaries that you are between the people who actually develop the ideas to be funded, that we should certainly be talking to them, which we're going to try and figure out a way to do, and that they may be the main audience, as they certainly are for ETV and others, although I heard the ETV superstructure is possible. I mean that in the sense of who are the people doing the technical panels is helpful for you all to validate, but that we may be not the, your, well, what do I want to say, our mail isn't the first you'll open, let me just put it that way, on these subjects. I mean, in the sense of, if I balance the amount of effort it takes to produce these needs and these, I'm just trying to test the water here.
I think it may depend on the group, because I think with Illinois Ventures and also probably with Arch and some groups like that, you should speak for yourself about it, but I mean, I was speaking more for the
Angel side, which I expect.
But I think it's very different. I mean, maybe very different.
I don't know, I think this is the first time I've seen that, and that particular version of the document, it's actually quite difficult to get. It's good to see. If the odds of it producing a fundable idea of are low, but it's quite useful to see, provided, presuming that it's not, terribly arduous.
I mean, the red document, just once you start that and we get it perfected, we only do, we have 300 or 400 in the mill at any one time, and only 30 or 40 get added. So once we get the list down, then it's going to be once, twice a year, the reg agenda, that you add 20 or 30, or maybe 5 of the 20 or 30 that are actually content, the rest are reporting, some other nuance. So that's not a huge effort if it's, and your point, the point we just talked about of portraying it on a, visually or other ways on what's coming up next, right, versus longer term. So that probably could do some work, not that much work. The needs, I don't think, are going to change. The folks sitting here face those problems every day, and we're going to continue to have no bed bug solution as the bed bugs move up from the southeast in the spring, and we're not going to use pesticides on them. So be careful where you stay, I guess, in Cincinnati. But nonetheless, that problem is going to be with us a while. And we have to, work through, but the other things might come up that to be added to this list. So, I mean, I think we're planning to put this stuff, these documents, this meeting up on our website here in Region 5, and we certainly have, for those of you who are here's email, we can let you know when there's a shift in that, if that's helpful. But we are trying to figure out how to, apropos of this advisory committee report that drove all this, how do we have a regular dialogue that says we're here, we care about developments, and it sounds like several of you, reading what we send will be useful, I guess, is the other yin to my yang about whether it's for Angels or Ventures. So. On the phone, anybody, Bob or anyone else, want to make a comment about closing us up here? Not that you're obligated.
I didn't really have anything else to say.
Okay. Thank you for being with us. Anyone else on the phone? Those of you who are still on the internet, there is a closing out button for you to get feedback on whether this worked for you or not, both in terms of mechanically, but also the way in which the content works. And we'd appreciate if you have a couple of minutes to go ahead and give that rating. And it's kind of like, it's not exactly a training course, but it is a seminar. So, I'd like to thank those of you who made a trip and down the street and also on the phone, took the time to read things. As I say, if you want to pass the word, we might send you notice that we are going to have this meeting a little half hour longer on October 26th in our big conference room downstairs. We're going to invite all the universities in our six-state region with over 15,000 students, so that'll mean going to their vice presidents of tech transfer and research. We're going to invite all the members of the Association of Environmental Engineering and Science Professors who belong in this six-state region plus Missouri. We're going to invite all the chapters of AICHE, ASCE, ASME, IEEE in Chicago and in the major cities in our six-state region. So we're trying to bump in, but of course that, and vendors are welcome, but I don't have a way to write a note to every company that might be interested in what we do. So we might send you that invitation since you were here or on the phones to pass on to anyone else. And we have three common people commenting, like, as we're most grateful for Keith and Ira and Bob. We have Alan Dines from the Midwest Research University Network. Dr. Kathy Banks, who's a principal civil engineering professor at Purdue University, a longtime researcher in biological and other activities. And I'm blanking out, aren't I? Oh, Jerry Zielinski, the president of Northern Illinois Research Foundation, who's the former vice president at Lucent Technologies R&D Center, who's done some R&D in the past. So they're going to be our commenters, but of course the room hopefully will have a lot of the kind of people you mentioned, actual PIs or their graduate students or other people who want to come and hear about needs and regs, and we'll get a reaction from them too. So, any final comments? Thanks to GSA for being here. Remember them. They want to have a skin on their building that draws energy and requires no need to go to ComEd anymore. And we thank the company. Okay. Maybe we made a connection there. Well, thank you on the phone. Thanks to Jim Gallup and April and Teresa and to Alan and Kathy Schneider here in the room. So I'll sign off, and please, if you're on the Internet and have a minute, please fill out the evaluation form. Thanks so much for being with us.